Welcome to this audio issue of Best Buys, published and copyrighted by Porter & Company, all rights reserved. Please note that this recording was generated via AI and may contain minor transcription errors and pronunciation mistakes. Throughout this issue, I may reference charts, graphs, and imagery that can only be viewed on our website at porterandcompanyresearch.com. This issue was originally published on Thursday, December 18, 2025. December 2025 Best Buys. When the Army needs advice, it turns to these guys. A wide moat fortified by government bureaucracy. John Pierpont Morgan didn't care that 5,000 men might be about to lose their thumbs. All that mattered to him was that he was about to sell 5,000 defective rifles for $22.50 apiece, after paying only $3.50. Morgan knew the guns were no good, out-of-date Hall carbines, manufactured back in 1819 and auctioned as condemned property after exploding in soldiers' faces. But it was 1861, the start of the American Civil War, and he'd hooked a government buyer who was desperate for supplies. After the first shots on Fort Sumter, a wild crew of pirate-like merchants had descended on the U.S. government, promising to sell them everything they needed for the war effort, and quite often, selling bad stuff for too much money. The defective goods, delivered, of course, after payment had been rendered, included lame horses, leaking boats, rotting uniforms, and exploding, overpriced muskets. The spook on the other end of the musket deal was U.S. Senator John C. Fremont, a wild card who issued his own Emancipation Proclamation 4 years before President Abraham Lincoln issued his, and as a result, was relieved of his military command. He likely knew the guns were faulty too, and he wasn't authorized to make weapons purchases to begin with. But the newly formed Union Army needed firearms, and Fremont wasn't picky, or much of a rule follower. So an anonymous arms merchant sourced the rifles, and 24-year-old Morgan, operating out of a modest one-room banking office, brokered the deal and pocketed the markup. And until the New York Times broke a story about the scandalous Hall carbine affair a few months later, no one was the wiser. The Times expose triggered major outrage and a congressional investigation into procurement fraud. Weevilly flour and sinking boats, it turned out, were everywhere. So in marched a little-known American hero to save the day, Quartermaster Montgomery Meigs. Meigs, who'd likely be diagnosed somewhere on the spectrum today, was a stickler for correct procedure. An architect who designed bridges and public buildings in his spare time, he had a sharp eye for detail, a solid reputation, and god-awful handwriting. At one point, he sent a scribbled report to General William Tecumseh Sherman, who replied, "The handwriting of this report is that of General Meigs, and I therefore approve of it, but I cannot read it." It didn't take Meigs long to whip the government contracting apparatus into shape. He ran off fraudsters, implemented rigorous quality control systems, and, most famously, waited at the end of General Sherman's grueling march to the sea with a stockpile of fresh clothes, hot food, and bedding for 62,000 weary Union soldiers. Meigs' efforts also laid the groundwork for the U.S. government's seminal legislation on keeping contractors honest, the False Claims Act, FCA, passed in 1863. The FCA sharply regulated merchants who wanted to sell goods to the government. It fined and jailed them for trying to foist off poor products, and it offered a hefty reward, up to 50% of the recovered funds, for whistleblowers who tipped off Congress to unethical business practices. Young J.P. Morgan, however, managed to sidestep consequences from his shady arms deal. He skedaddled with his 550% markup and used it to expand his one-room office into a respectable financial firm on Wall Street, one you may have heard of today. But in general, the FCA established a much-needed set of checks and balances on the procurement industry. And for the next 80 years, it remained the gold standard regulating the government's dealings with outside contractors, until President Franklin Delano Roosevelt waltzed in. Beg, borrow, steal. FDR, the proto-socialist architect of the New Deal, believed that big government was like monosodium glutamate, it just went well with everything and made everything a little better. He had a fetish for expanding the government's traditionally limited powers into all corners of private industry, and to hear him tell it, he'd single-handedly lifted the U.S. out of the Great Depression by giving struggling businesses a well-placed boost. "We use the facilities and resources available only to government to permit individual enterprise to resume its normal functions in a socially sound competitive order. We provided credit at one end of the business mechanism and purchasing power at the other. The broken pipes of the circulatory system of business have been welded together again." World War II, and its sudden, urgent need for boats and planes and bullets, offered an enticing playground for FDR to subsidize the defense industry on a grand scale. By 1942, he'd already commandeered the production lines of automakers Ford and Chrysler and ordered them to stamp out planes, trains, and automobiles for the war effort. But he had bigger plans. He wanted the government to fund whole companies. aircraft makers like Boeing and Lockheed Martin, shipbuilders like Bethlehem Steel, creating the streamlined government and private industry partnership of his wet dreams. Under the auspices of two bodies called the Office of Production Management and the War Production Board, he'd make massive advance payments, up to 30% of the total contract, construct $11 billion, about $200 billion today, worth of additional facilities for the contractors to use, and do away with profit limits. He wanted all this to happen quickly, without red tape, without holdups, and without inconvenient whistleblowers. The only thing standing in his way was good old Montgomery Meigs' False Claims Act. FDR set out to weaken the act with a series of 1943 congressional amendments that slashed the original safeguards Meigs had put in place. Whistleblowers now had to jump through prohibitive hoops for lower rewards, and contractors could take big handouts from the government with much less oversight. The FCA wilted, and the government contracting industry bloomed into something far larger than FDR could have imagined. The shadow government. By the end of the war, FDR had poured over $175 billion, in 1940s dollars, into the eager maws of defense contractors, with two-thirds of those contracts going to just 100 companies. Along the way, the contractors figured out they could pretty much do whatever they wanted, and the government would pay for their steak and chocolate-covered strawberries. Between 1948 and 1989, the government spent over $10 trillion, in today's dollars, on national defense, most of which disappeared into an incestuous, revolving door network of civilian and military buddies. Waste, fraud, and abuse abounded. By the 1980s, in an eerie echo of the Civil War procurement scandals of over a century earlier, major contractors openly padded their invoices to the tune of $400 a hammer and $7,000 a coffee pot. In a panic, Congress attempted to bring back a revised version of the FCA, but by then, the lame horse was out of the stable. Trillions of dollars were already pledged to maintain American interests overseas in the 1980s, 1990s, and 2000s, especially in the aftermath of 9/11. In 2019 alone, the Pentagon spent more than half of its annual $676 billion defense budget on contracting. Like it or not, the military-industrial complex, with all its cronyism and bloat, was here to stay. Here, too, to rule. We now have, in effect, a fourth branch of government, a shadow branch composed of incredibly powerful defense contractors who are unelected and unaccountable, control hundreds of billions of dollars, and, by way of lobbying, think tanks and civil advisory positions, directly shape much of our domestic and foreign policy. In the words of investigative reporter Dan Gutman, who wrote a foundational 1970s exposé on these contractors called The Shadow Government, "The public is not aware who is making decisions in this country. We find agencies delegating large chunks of themselves to one or more firms over a number of years and, in effect, saying, run this portion of the agency." Flush with government cash, private defense contractors exercise outsized influence over our politics, spending about $100 million a year to lobby lawmakers, and nearly $200 million over the past decade to fund super PACs and political campaigns, and ultimately to get their projects and products into the government ecosystem. If you guess that they funded a larger percentage of Republican campaigns, you are right. Of course, they are all a key reason the U.S. government hires businesses like the one we are placing in this month's Best Buys. Managing weapon systems, software platforms, high-tech communications, and the people who run them require a skill set Uncle Sam does not have. Is this a good thing that the government needs to outsource so much of what it does? Certainly not. Is it a good investment opportunity? Most certainly yes. Quartermaster Meigs would be horrified. This month's Best Buys is one of the best and safest of these shadow government companies. If you're not already a subscriber to Best Buys, click here or call our customer care team at 888-610-8895 or internationally at +1-443-815-4447 for more information on getting access to this publication. 1. Booz Allen Hamilton, NYSE. BH Booz Allen Hamilton, NYSE. BAH is a leading provider of consulting and technology services to the U.S. government. Why we recommended Booz Allen? Founder Edwin Booz started this company in 1914 to solve his clients' most difficult issues through the use of science. Years later, a business owner Booz had worked with became the Secretary of the Navy and asked Booz and his partner James Allen to help get the country ready for World War II. They created detailed flowcharts, pioneered performance metrics, and introduced what would now be called change management. In essence, Booz and Allen taught the Navy how to think like a business, and to do it fast. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, the U.S. entered the war with its military infrastructure in better shape than it had ever been. Once the war ended, America didn't go back to business as usual. The military-industrial complex had been born, and it needed permanent upkeep. Edwin Booz and James' firm, Booz Allen, became the gold standard for this new world. Booz Allen expanded its federal work, taking on clients across the Pentagon, the CIA, NASA, and later the Department of Homeland Security. What had started with a few consultants and Navy offices grew into thousands of employees supporting nearly every major federal agency. Today, the firm helps lead cybersecurity efforts, engineer artificial intelligence, AI, systems for defense, and even advise on space operations. Booz Allen is a $13 billion market cap company that generated $10.6 billion in revenue in 2024, an increase of 15% over 2023. By relying primarily on human and intangible capital, the business is highly capital efficient, generating 57% returns on equity over the past 5 years. And it has quietly been one of the best performing stocks in the market, generating 22% compounded annual returns since going public in 2010. About 95% of all Booz Allen revenue comes from the U.S. government. Close to 50% of the company's sales are to defense customers, 35% are in the civil segment, and most of the rest is in national security. Booz is the number one provider of cybersecurity services to the government. Cyber makes up about $3 billion in revenue to Booz each year, about 25% of the total company. Nowhere is that more evident right now than in AI. The proliferation of AI is one of the most powerful themes in the stock market today. The federal government is working to accelerate its AI capabilities for greater productivity and efficiency. The firm is the number one provider of AI services to the U.S. government. It does 8x more business with the government than its nearest competitor. Smart investors like businesses with wide moats. Booz has over 35,000 total employees. Within that, there are 22,000 technologists, 6,000 top-tier software engineers, 8,000 cyber professionals, and 2,500 AI experts. About 70% of their employees hold security clearances, and 28% of their employees are former military. Talk about a wide moat that would be tough for anyone to replicate. Though its Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, initiative has lost steam since Elon Musk first began rooting his way around departments and agencies earlier this year, the Trump administration is looking for ways to slash government spending and increase efficiency. That has meant headcount reductions, spending cuts, and contract reviews. Booz Allen's civil division has felt more pressure from cuts, and that business is expected to decline low double digits. Why Booz Allen Hamilton is a best buy? Investors should think of these cuts more as a reset rather than the end. Civil revenue is expected to resume growth by early 2026. DOGE is essentially dead, and Booz investors have probably seen the worst of its actions. And meanwhile, Booz isn't just sitting idly by. The company is reducing its own headcount 7% in response to sluggish revenue. This should position Booz well for the future. Why should investors be so confident in a rebound here? This goes back to the benefits of being a legal monopoly. Being entrenched as a dominant player with leading market share should lead to highly predictable and mostly recurring revenue. Sure enough, investors can see it in the numbers given Booz's long track record of success. The firm has grown revenue every year over the past 10 years. Its average annual growth rate has been almost 9%. Earnings per share, EPS, has grown even faster, at an average annual rate of over 17% during that same period. Even during this reset year, revenue and EPS should still be up. Not bad for a down year. At its current price of $88 per share, BAH is trading at a price-to-earnings, P/E, ratio of 14x. The P/E ratio here has ranged from 16x to as high as 28x over the past 10 years. So today this stock is as cheap as it has been in the past decade. Just a historical average multiple of 21x on next year's $7.40 of earnings would mean a $155 stock, a huge upside from today's price. Normally, that kind of potential gain is reserved for very risky companies, not legal monopolies with a long track record of growth year in and year out. No more consulting is needed here. This stock is a buy. Action to take. Buy Booz Allen Hamilton, NYSE, BAH up to $125 per share. 2. Venture Global, NYSE, VG. Headquartered in Arlington, Virginia, Venture Global, NYSE, VG, is a fast-growing liquefied natural gas, LNG, exporter founded in 2013 by Michael Sobel and Robert Pender. It launched its initial public offering, IPO, in January of this year. Why we recommended Venture Global? Venture Global was founded based on a simple, yet bold proposal, to build LNG projects faster, cheaper, and better than anyone else. The company pioneered a new approach to LNG terminal construction, based on smaller liquefaction trains, pre-built in off-site facilities and shipped directly to the project site. Compared with the traditional method of custom-building LNG terminals, this results in more of a plug-and-play approach. The hard work of building the most critical element of the project, the liquefaction train, is already completed beforehand and off-site. Thus, the only work left to do is set up the supporting infrastructure, power generation, pipeline connections, etc., and put all the pieces together. The company calls this the design one, build many approach, meaning it only needs to create one liquefaction train design, which can then be used for all future projects. This makes Venture Global's construction process highly scalable and repeatable, instead of starting each project with a new customized design. This more efficient construction method allowed the company to complete its first project, the 12.4 million ton per annum MTL Calcasieu Pass LNG terminal, in record time. The project received final investment decision, the official go-ahead, in August 2019, and began shipping its first cargo less than 2.5 years later in Q1 2022. That's a full year faster than the timeline for a comparable facility brought online by Venture Global's key competitor Cheniere Energy, LNG, America's leading LNG exporter. The beauty of this modular approach is that it's highly scalable, meaning additional larger facilities can be brought online in roughly the same amount of time. Venture Global completed its second project, the Plaquemines LNG terminal, with twice the capacity as its first project, in roughly the same amount of time. It simply shipped in twice as many pre-built liquefaction trains, raising the number from 18 to 36. Venture Global now has two facilities producing LNG, its Calcasieu Pass and Plaquemines terminals. The record speed of construction allowed the company to rapidly scale up its business from zero earnings in 2021 to an expected $6.6 billion in EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, this year. That's just 5% shy of what Cheniere is expected to generate in 2025. Venture Global expects to generate $15 billion in revenue in 2026. And this is just the beginning. Venture Global is on the cusp of receiving approval to proceed with construction of its next project, known as Calcasieu Pass 2, CP2. With a nameplate capacity of 28 MPTA, CP2 will be America's largest LNG terminal. Venture Global expects to begin producing cargoes at full scale by the late 2020s, at which point it should overtake Cheniere as America's leading LNG exporter. The company also has two massive projects in the works following CP2, which, if completed, would make Venture Global the single largest LNG exporter in the world, exceeding the capacity of the entire country of current global leader Qatar. Why Venture Global is a best buy? Venture Global's finances and share price suffered following a legal setback in arbitration proceedings with oil giant BP. The dispute stemmed from LNG cargo deliveries that Venture Global diverted away from BP in 2022 toward the higher price spot market. However, the legal liability is not a thesis killer, and rather easily absorbed by Venture Global's $6.6 billion projected 2025 EBITDA and deep access capital. The market's fear of contagion to other legacy 2022 disputes is overstated. With contract structures now amended to prevent recurrence and the LNG demand story unchanged, the other legal proceedings would be a one-time cash hit that ultimately clears the deck for a cleaner operating future, making shares worthy of best buy status. With Venture Global on the verge of securing regulatory approval for its third project, we believe now is the time to own a share in what will soon become America's leading LNG exporter. At our buy-up to price of $20 per share, Venture's enterprise value, EV, comes out to $78 billion. That reflects a forward valuation multiple of 11.8x EV/EBITDA, based on 2025 estimated EBITDA of $6.6 billion. Conversely, the $78 billion EV of Venture's main competitor Cheniere translates into a forward EV/EBITDA ratio of 11.3x. At $6 per share, Venture Global trades for less than 8x EV/EBITDA. We believe Venture should command a significant valuation premium over Cheniere, given the advantages of its construction approach, its aggressive future expansion potential, and its track record of successfully executing on prior growth plans. Action to take: buy Venture Global, NYSE, VG, up to $20 per share. 3. The Hershey Company, NYSE, HSY shares of this famous chocolate maker remain below where we think they should be, so we are keeping the Hershey Company, NYSE, HSY, as part of best buys. We also see Celsius, NASDAQ, sell, at a very attractive buy price, so it remains a best buy as well. We have removed Japanese finance conglomerate Mitsui & Company, OTC, Mitsui, because its share price has increased 40% over the last month. We remain bullish on Mitsui & Company but believe Booz Allen, Hershey, and Celsius are currently at a more compelling price. Why we recommended Hershey? Founded in 1894, Hershey owns a portfolio of some of the most iconic candy brands of all time, including Hershey's Bars, Hershey's Kisses, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, Kit Kat, Twizzlers, and Almond Joy. The enduring value of these and other brands allows it to sell more candy every year, at ever-increasing prices. As a result, Hershey has consistently grown revenue, earned hefty profit margins, and returned a steady and growing share of profits to shareholders through dividends and share buybacks. Since Porter first recommended Hershey in 2007, the company has grown revenue 127% or 4.9% annually. However, what is more impressive is that during this period, Hershey's earnings per share, EPS, increased a phenomenal 1,040% or 15.4% annually. Hershey shares are down 9% from when we recommended them at $185 in April 2024. Skyrocketing cocoa prices contributed to Hershey's share price decline as the cost of this key ingredient soared above $10,000 per metric ton. It has since declined a bit, but the share price has yet to recover. Why Hershey is a best buy? Hershey beat expectations across the board in its Q3 earnings report on October 30th, with EPS of $1.30, 24 cents ahead of expectations, and revenue of $3.18 billion, $60 million better than analyst estimates. The notable takeaway from the Q3 report was that Hershey appears to have regained its pricing power, notching a 6% increase in prices while volumes remained steady. The company reported strong results across all major segments, including a 5% increase in North American confectionery sales, a 10% increase in North American salty snacks, and 12% growth in international revenue. Margins remain tight due to the high cocoa prices locked in via this year's hedging program, with gross margins down 8.5 percentage points year-over-year to 31.8%. However, the good news is that cocoa prices have dropped by over 50% from a peak of $12,800 per ton last December to $6,200 currently. Based on the strength of its latest results and lower costs from falling cocoa prices, Hershey raised its 2025 guidance to 3% sales growth, up from 2% previously. The company expects to earn $5.95 per share this year, and we expect this will be the low point in Hershey's earnings going forward. With revenue on track to reach $12 billion next year, that puts our estimate of normalized net income at between $1.8 billion to $2.4 billion. At a current market capitalization of $38 billion, that puts Hershey's forward P/E ratio at between 16x and 21x. That's a compelling bargain for one of the most iconic brands of all time. Action to take: buy the Hershey Company, NYSE, HSY, up to $200 per share. Every month, we highlight three current portfolio picks that are at an attractive buy point, and we include those with the best buying opportunity as our best buys. While we regularly alternate which companies we list as our best buys, removing a stock from the list does not necessarily mean we no longer recommend it to its buy-up to price, nor does it imply a recommendation to sell shares in that company once it is no longer a best buys. It's only that the new picks present an even more compelling investment opportunity. Let us know what you think. Feedback at porterandcompanyresearch.com. Mailbag. Hi, I have a question about the returns on best buys. Is it based on the assumption that when a best buy is removed from the list that the investor sells it, or is it based on a buy and hold to date? I have often invested in best buys in which I had not previously invested, and haven't sold any of them. Sherwin R. Porter & Company comment. Sherwin, thanks for writing in, and great to hear that you have not sold the best buys that you have previously purchased. Our intent in removing a stock from the best buys list is not to recommend selling it. It's just that other stocks and Complete Investor represent a more compelling investment opportunity. In fact, we removed Mitsui & Company, MITSI, from the best buys list because the share price rose 20% over the last month, making it great to own but not great to buy. And when calculating the returns on past best buys, the end date on the calculation is based on buy and hold, as you phrase it. We simply base the return on the current price, which does not necessarily mean shares were sold. Whenever we recommend selling shares of a Complete Investor recommendation, we will make it clear to Complete Investor subscribers, either in a portfolio update issue or in a direct sell alert email to readers. Porter & Company. Stevenson, Maryland. Thank you for being a paid subscriber to Porter & Company. We hope you enjoyed this audio issue.